The United Nations meets Fox News today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump picks a former Fox News host to be his ambassador to the UN. Camera ready? Sure. Good fit? Maybe not.
The role of a UN Security Council ambassador is not about communication and spin. It's about extremely canny, tough negotiations.
Also, the UN's top human rights official brings relevant and painful life experiences to her job.
One man told me, "I'm so happy that you were in jail and tortured." So I said, "Oh, come on, guy, that's not a nice thing to say."
Plus, two chairs, no waiting, African men and barbershop conversations, no matter where they are.
Sometimes the barbershop was just a place under a tree and a dude with a blade.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to be with you on this Friday. President Trump has made his pick. He wants his next ambassador to the United Nations to be Heather Nauert. She's currently the spokesperson over at the State Department, so she has some diplomatic experience. But there might be another reason she was picked for the job by President Trump.
Fox and Friends in the Morning is the best show, and it's the absolute most honest show.
Before her job at the State Department, Heather Nauert was one of the hosts on President Trump's favorite TV show. Anne-Marie Gutz is a professor of global affairs at New York University. I asked her how much real foreign policy experience matters for a UN ambassador.
The trouble with this kind of an appointment is that in this particular case, in the Heather Nauert case, her experience internationally and in government is extremely thin. And the role of a UN Security Council ambassador is not about communication and spin. It's about extremely canny, tough negotiations to resolve some seriously intractable crises around the world. And that skill, it could come from journalism. Other UN ambassadors have had a journalistic background, like Samantha Power, for example. But we've not seen much evidence of that yet in Heather Nauert.
Well, there's also word from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that he wants the position of UN ambassador downgraded. It's currently a cabinet appointment, which is why we often see Nikki Haley in pictures of cabinet meetings. Pompeo does not want the next UN ambassador on the cabinet. What do you think that's about?
This was a move that was anticipated. It was already a possibility when Nikki Haley took the job, but she negotiated hard to retain the cabinet position. Downgrading the UN ambassador away from the cabinet is a worrying sign. Any UN appointment, any leadership appointment of a national representative to the UN is a signal of what that country thinks about multilateralism and its level of priority domestically. And by downgrading the post and appointing somebody who may not have the qualifications or experience that are relevant for the job, that sends a signal of the significance of multilateralism to the administration.
I'm wondering if you see the appointment of two people with little experience as a way to continue to diminish the UN or at least the U.S. relationship with it.
Well, there's no doubt about it. And let's also not forget John Bolton's role in all of this. He would want to have the UN ambassador being in a significantly or visibly junior position to him. He himself, of course, was an ambassador to the UN. He was a Bush appointee, and he famously said, if you lopped off the top 10 floors of the UN, you would not see a difference in world policy, which expressed his sort of contemptuous attitude towards the UN and its work. So this appointment could be part of this entire pattern of diminishing the UN's role in the most important multilateral institution that we have in the most important international peace and security section of the UN, which is the Security Council.
Professor Gutz, you're a former advisor on peace and security issues to the United Nations agency, UN Women.
That's right.
What would you say about the way gender plays a role in the selection of Nauert?
The gender of ambassadors to the Security Council is of considerable interest to feminists who work on peace and security around the world, because the Council has traditionally been an exceptionally strikingly male-dominated domain. The fact that Heather Nauert is a woman does not tell us much at all about her position on women's rights. And the same was true for Nikki Haley, who was known in South Carolina for her anti-abortion positions, for example. In relation to Heather Nauert, we don't know much. We know that in February this year, as the State Department spokesperson, she defended a move in the State Department's annual human rights report, a move to excise the content on threats to women's reproductive rights around the world. It's hard to imagine the administration, given what we know about its position on women's rights, especially reproductive rights. It's hard to imagine the administration would appoint somebody who is a staunch defender of women's reproductive rights, including abortion rights. So to come back to your question, it's extremely important to have more diversity on the Security Council and to have more women. But what matters more is to have more feminists. And men can be feminists too, of course. And we would want to watch closely how Heather Nauert handles gender issues on the Security Council.
Anne-Marie Gutz is a professor of global affairs at New York University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Not many people would question the qualifications of Michelle Bachelet. She's been at the UN since September as their new human rights chief. Bachelet served twice as president of Chile. In between, she was the first ever executive director of UN Women. But more relevant than any job, Bachelet's personal experiences during Chile's dictatorship. She opposed military rule, was jailed and tortured because of her opposition. Same with her father before he died in prison. This week, Michelle Bachelet told the BBC that all of that informs what she will do as the UN's new human rights chief.
As a matter of fact, in my first meeting with NGOs, one man told me, "I'm so happy that you were in jail and tortured." So I said, "Oh, come on, guy, that's not a nice thing to say." But I understood exactly what he was mentioning. I mean, he was saying, "Look, we don't have to explain to you. You have lived this and you understand exactly. So you can be, if I would say, standing on our shoes, so you can be an ally." And that's why I'm telling you, I hope that my whole story and my whole experience will be helpful in my way of doing my job.
That job takes a delicate balance, according to Bachelet, between publicly calling out countries that violate human rights and taking a more diplomatic approach.
I do want to speak out, but I also want to have outcomes and results. And sometimes you can have very good outcomes speaking out. And sometimes you can have better outcomes with engaging government in order that they really can respect human rights. We have to speak out every time that we need it, but we need to strategize better, to be even smarter, because the world is so complicated right now, so challenging.
And there's only so much the UN human rights chief can do. For example, the case of murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Bachelet admits her office had its limits.
Since the beginning, we mentioned, as soon as we knew a bit of information about it, we called for an international investigation. We thought, we said it publicly in a press release, that only a Turkish and Saudi investigation would not be enough. We needed the truth to come out, and for that, an international investigation was needed. But we don't have that on our mandate. We cannot proceed with a criminal investigation. So we have mentioned this, and it's now the time for member states to define and to decide to go on with a criminal investigation.
Michelle Bachelet, who's been the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights since September, speaking there with our colleagues at the BBC. Meanwhile, the UN is hosting a pivotal climate summit right now in Poland. The meeting is supposed to put some muscle behind the 2015 Paris Agreement, but it comes at a time of intense political and economic challenges, not to mention a ton of dire climate news. One of the biggest challenges is how to quickly move the world away from reliance on coal for electricity. Ironic, given where the UN meeting is, Poland's reliance on coal goes deep. It's economic and cultural. Here's reporter Rachel Waldholz in Katowice, Poland.
The building doesn't look like much. It's in a nondescript neighborhood in Katowice, Poland, right next to the railroad tracks. But outside, there's a small sign with the red logo of Solidarity, the storied trade union that helped bring down Poland's communist government in 1989. Kazimierz Grzarek fought with Solidarity in the 80s. Today, the workers he represents include many coal miners. So I wanted to ask what he thinks about the future of coal in Poland. His answer? No way is Poland leaving it behind. If Poland gives up coal, Grzarek says, it's wasting one of the most beautiful gifts of the earth. Poland's economy runs on coal. It supplies nearly 80% of the nation's electricity. Much of the country still uses it to heat their homes. And there's still about 100,000 coal miners here. And mining unions are a big political force and close allies of the ruling Law and Justice Party. Then there's the psychological power of coal.
Dlaczego dla Polski węgiel jest taki bardzo ważny?
Coal gives us energy independence, Grzarek says. We have enough to be completely self-sufficient for many years. And that means Poland doesn't have to rely on its neighbors and former occupiers, Russia and Germany, for energy. Coal is the dirtiest major energy source, but Grzarek argues that technology can make coal climate friendly. And he bristles at the idea that coal is a particularly Polish problem.
Australia, Indonesia, India.
He ticks off the names of places that he says produce more and asks, why should Poland quit coal when other countries are still mining? That question is a big part of the Global Climate Summit happening right now here in Katowice. The UN scientific panel has concluded that the world has to zero out carbon emissions by the middle of this century to avoid the worst impacts of global warming. To meet that goal, a recent analysis says Poland and other members of the European Union must phase out coal in less than 15 years. But the Polish government insists coal will remain a big source of energy for decades to come. And that's why some worry that Poland might use its role as the host of this year's summit to resist an ambitious agreement on carbon pollution. The Polish official in charge of the meeting says that fear is unfounded. Michal Kurtyka says his country's reliance on coal can actually help it forge a strong deal.
This puts us in a unique position to understand very different situations all around the world in terms of climate policy.
The challenge facing this year's conference is huge. Countries must agree on how to fill in the gaps left in the breakthrough 2015 Paris Agreement, including such basic things as how to measure emissions cuts. Kurtyka says Poland understands what's at stake.
Paris are the principles, Katowice is the implementation. So in this regard, without Katowice, there is no Paris.
Activists agree, but they worry about a weak outcome here.
If Polish presidency will not find ways to bridge different sides of negotiations, we may not succeed.
Ursula Stefanovic runs a group of NGOs called the Polish Climate Coalition. And she says the government is selling its own citizens short by not preparing for the inevitable.
Our government makes this mistake of not talking to the miners honestly, treating them as children and telling them everything will be fine, nothing will change, you don't have to worry.
But Stefanovic says it won't be fine.
Changes have to come, and to make it socially just and secure, they have to be planned.
Planned or not, those changes may already be on the way.
It's not actually the question if Poland will get rid of coal, but when.
Joanna Makowiak-Pandera is the head of Forum Energy, an energy think tank in Warsaw.
I think the energy transition is the direction in which Polish energy sector will move, with or without support of the decision makers, because you cannot stop global megatrends.
An agreement on that comes from a surprising direction, Poland's state-controlled utilities.
The pressure from the global economy will be such that if we don't change towards less carbon-intensive, we might lose some business.
That's Monika Morawiecka, an executive at Poland's biggest power company, speaking recently with reporters. Morawiecka says she can start to imagine a future without coal, because renewable energy is no longer out of reach for Poland.
Previously, we were saying, look, this is very old, very nice and beautiful, these wind farms and the solar panels, but we cannot afford them. Now we are saying, okay, now we can afford them.
The big concern is what it will mean for workers. Morawiecka says her company alone employs 42,000 people. The Polish government is starting to think about this too. At the climate conference, they're emphasizing the idea of a just transition to a low-carbon future. Kazimierz Grzarek of Solidarity will be at the conference too, leading a coalition of trade unions. But he isn't ready to consider any transition. If I admit we must implement a just transition, he says, then I'd have to admit that what's going on in Poland now is unjust. And that's not the case. Grzarek insists his members are sticking with coal. But Poland itself may be moving on. For The World, Rachel Waldholz, Katowice, Poland.
That story was reported with support from Clean Energy Wire. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you run an agency that resettles refugees, these days you might not have a lot of work. You're lucky if your agency is even still open. That's because the Trump administration continues to cut to record lows the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. From Los Angeles, here's KCRW's Saul Gonzalez with our story.
I can use the benches for food too.
It's a warm Sunday afternoon in Los Angeles, and families have gathered in a park to enjoy the day and each other's company. It looks like a classically American scene, but many here are refugees who recently arrived in the United States, fleeing violence and persecution in some of the world's most dangerous countries, like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria.
We walk, me and my family, my mother, my wife, my four kids, we walk from Syria to Jordan. We went to the camps of the refugees in Jordan. We lived there like 4 years. Then we came here.
That's Ayman Issa, a one-time barber in Damascus who was driven out of his native country by its bloody civil war. He says if he hadn't fled Syria when he did, he wouldn't be alive.
We felt like we are dead.
You felt you were going to die?
Yeah. Everything's gone. Our homes, our trees, our everything. Our jobs, our stores, everything's gone. Everything, yes.
So it was life or death?
Yes.
Ayman, though, is lucky because he petitioned to come to the U.S. as a refugee and was accepted. But under the Trump administration, America's doors are closing. Refugee caps have been slashed from 110,000 a year to 30,000 next year. That would be the lowest number of refugees admitted since 1980.
Yeah, I think it's no secret. It's been a 180-degree change.
That's Martin Zog, the executive director of the L.A. Office of the International Rescue Committee, which resettles refugees in Southern California. Zog says as the U.S. reduces its refugee caps, the number of people his office helps has plummeted.
It's translated into reducing the number of refugees to a tenth of what we had anticipated.
A tenth?
That's right. So typically we would resettle between 2,500 and 3,000 refugees in this region every year. Last year, we hit about 400. This year, we're going to be probably far less than that.
But at least Zog's office is still open. 5 out of 9 refugee agencies in the L.A. area have closed because of reduced refugee numbers, and others are cutting back services.
And as we go forward, it's very likely that we'll see even further reductions here.
At the park gathering, Ayman Issa says that although he's happy to be in the U.S., he thinks frequently of all the refugees who now won't be able to get into the country because of the Trump administration's caps. Knowing what it's like to feel desperation as a refugee, Ayman believes they'll lose all hope.
Sometimes when you haven't any hope of life and all the doors are closed in front of you, sometimes you prefer to death.
You prefer to die?
Yeah. When you find all the doors are closed, it's the death.
But even as refugee numbers are cut, some believe that creates opportunities for American refugee agencies to think more creatively about how they help newcomers to this country. That includes putting them in touch with more ordinary Americans.
We want to make it easy and enjoyable for people to get involved to directly help their resettling neighbors.
That's Mary Whitehill, a former advertising executive who in 2016 founded the refugee aid group Miri's List. It organized the gathering at the park, which brought together the refugees with American families.
Jada, do you know Rabia?
Whitehill believes big refugee agencies can be more nimble and create a pro-refugee constituency in the U.S. by harnessing social media and crowdsourcing so Americans can meet and help refugees directly.
And to really put a face and a picture and an experience, to meet a family, to sit down with them, get to know their culture through food, get to hear some of their family stories. You know, these are the things that will stick with us in our memories and in our hearts.
Whitehill says interacting with Americans also allows refugees to feel, well, less like refugees and more like ordinary people.
What we focus on are the things that make people feel alive. Intervening is the difference in their arrival being a continuation of their refugee experience versus the end of their refugee experience and the beginning of their new life here in America.
Ayman Issa says the Americans he's met through Whitehill's group have helped him assimilate into American life. But as the U.S. cuts refugee numbers, he wishes elected officials could look beyond the politics of the issue and see refugees as ordinary people trying to find a better and safer life.
Actually, I hate politics. Yeah, I hate borders. It is earth. It is for everybody, I think.
For The World, I'm Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
If you are a refugee already in the U.S., it's also become much harder to get asylum. According to a study from Syracuse University, asylum denials have hit a record high. 65% of asylum claims were denied in fiscal year 2018, which ended in September. It was the sixth consecutive year the denial rate went up. We asked Sarah Pierce to help us understand why. She's with the Migration Policy Institute.
So it's hard to say. It could be a change of the makeup of individuals who are applying for asylum, but it's also very likely it's a change from the top down. It's a change from the administration. We know that this administration in particular is putting a lot of pressure on immigration judges to adjudicate cases more quickly. In that process, it's possible that the judges aren't allowing immigrants to present their full proceedings, and that might be increasing the amount of denials. This administration also takes a very skeptical view at asylum seekers. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions handed out a decision that limited asylum for individuals who are applying based on fear of gang violence or domestic violence. So suddenly those individuals are going to have a lot harder time applying for asylum.
I suppose we shouldn't be surprised by this, given President Trump's views generally on immigration, but this is the sixth consecutive year of denials increasing. So what's going on with that prior to Trump?
So we've had a really big increase of individuals applying for asylum. In general, since the Great Recession in 2008, we've had an increase of humanitarian migrants coming to the southern border and asking for asylum. And that has had the result of increasing denials.
So as far as the pressure that the White House is putting on immigration judges, what form is that pressure taking?
They are limiting the tools that immigration judges have to manage their dockets. In the past, immigration judges, if they found a case that was particularly sympathetic or they thought that there were technical issues with the case, they could completely take it out of the immigration court entirely, or they could administratively close the case. Those two tools are now no longer available to immigration judges, and they've given immigration judges quotas.
And, I mean, what do you say to people? Well, this is why Trump was elected. He had a lot of support for people who wanted judges to get tighter on asylum claims.
So I think it's completely legitimate that we need to weed out fraud in our asylum system, especially when you're talking about asylum for individuals approaching our southern border. There's such a delay in the process between when they apply and when they ultimately get it. We're actually encouraging bad actors right now to take advantage of our asylum system. So while that's a legitimate pursuit, the way that the Trump administration is going about it, a lot of legitimate asylum seekers are getting swept up and punished in that process. And I think that's a very big problem.
Sarah Pierce, a policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute, a Washington, D.C. think tank. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm Marco Werman. In Iraq, women activists have established a secret network of shelters. They're meant to help women who are escaping honor killings, sex trafficking, and domestic violence.
Simply put, if they're found, they're killed.
Inside Iraq's secret shelters, that story plus the push for peace talks in Afghanistan. Still ahead here on The World. Hi, I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. According to the United Nations, nearly half of married women in Iraq have experienced some form of domestic violence. Activists in Iraq are trying to help victims by establishing secret shelters for them. And when I say secret, I mean secret from the women's families, but also from the police and the Iraqi government. My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil managed to gain access to one of these shelters in Baghdad. And let me just add, some of what we're about to hear is difficult to listen to.
The woman who started all of this, Marco, is Yanar Mohammed. Yanar is Iraqi. She used to live in Canada. She left Canada with the start of the war in Iraq in 2003. She said, I was watching TV, I saw my country falling apart, and my life in Canada just seemed meaningless. I didn't know what I was going to do back in Iraq, and I wanted to go back. And when she did, she started hearing from women about trafficking, about the need for shelter, about violence that's not combat violence, violence that they were experiencing at home or from their tribe, and the need for shelter. And she said, I just found this old, disused bank building. She started her NGO and she started sheltering women since then. And through her, we met Besma and Salwa. These are not the real names. We wanted to protect their identities. But these are women who came to her after years of abuse that they experienced on their own. She gave them shelter and education. They were able to get on their own two feet. And now Besma and Salwa have their own shelters. So they're helping other women as well.
I mean, it seems like a really important undertaking. Why are these shelters secret?
When I spoke to Yanar, she was adamant that these shelters are secret, they remain secret, and that we had to protect the privacy and the secrecy of these shelters. Let's hear what she has to say about why.
The shelters have to be secret because the abusers will still follow the women and try to kidnap them from us or to kill them. And in the same time, if the government wants to crack down on us, saying that we are being illegal, we need to be ready for that. If they know where we are, it means all the network of our shelters gets closed in the same day.
What are the risks, though, of women being in a shelter in Baghdad?
Simply put, if they're found, they're killed. It's the fact that many of these women have escaped honor killings, they've escaped traffickers, they've escaped abuse at home. And the fact that they escaped home in a society like Iraq is seen as a dishonor of the family. These are the kinds of risks that Yanar and the women take on when someone comes to their shelters, but also the fact that the government doesn't acknowledge them, doesn't support them, doesn't give them legal status. In fact, they say that they can raid them anytime. And if they do, this whole network then falls apart.
I mean, that's what I find baffling, why the government doesn't support these shelters.
They look at them with suspicion and they look at them in a way as an entity that encourages women to rebel against their families. Because, you know, don't forget that the Iraqi government is also governed by a lot of the norms and the traditions of Iraqi tribal life. And the government and the politicians don't want to be seen as encouraging an entity or an NGO that would tell women, well, if you're abused at home, leave home and come to us. They have to be really careful about that. When we spoke to them, actually, it was really interesting what they said. They said, look, we don't trust these places. We don't know if the women are being abused there. The women shouldn't really leave their families home. And if a woman should be in a shelter, it should be through a court order. And the problem with that, of course, is if a woman goes to court or if a woman goes to the police, the first people that they go to is the family, which in many cases are the very people that she's trying to run away from.
Well, perhaps one of the reasons it's not spoken about more openly is just some of the horrific stories that would come out. One of the women
Indeed.
You spoke with talked about how she had been sexually assaulted from the age of six.
They beat me constantly, and when their relatives came to visit, they would sexually harass me. I remember I was 6 years old, and they would sexually abuse me mercilessly. I tried to hide, to stay away, but I couldn't. And when this family left the country, I was moved to another house in Iraqi Kurdistan. But my life was the same. The beatings, the mistreatment, and the sexual violence. The man of the house then raped me.
Shaima, I mean, this is just so horrifying. How many of these women have left the shelters and managed to move on with their lives? I mean, that, I guess, is the upside here, isn't it?
It is the upside here. I mean, all in all, in the last 15 years, Yanar told me it was around 1,000 women, a little less than 1,000 women that she's helped, many of whom have left the shelters and either have gone to other cities in Iraq and have started jobs. Some of the women that we've met, for example, again, Salwa and Basma, they're still in Baghdad. They're now working within the NGO, but they're also running their own shelters. So they've kind of graduated in a way and are now starting their own shelters, receiving women. And I guess the great thing about this network is that, you know, when you've gone through that experience, as they tell me, you're able to deal with the women that are coming in because you're in the same boat. You've gone through what they've gone through. You know the fear. You know what it feels like that very first night when you've left a horrible situation and you finally are able to sleep. Well, you know, there's something, Marco, that will stay with me, I think, forever. What Salwa told me, I said, what was it like when you left all this abuse, all this harassment behind, and it was the first night that you slept in relative safety? And she said, I cannot tell you what it feels like when you sleep in a room and you're not afraid that someone is going to open up that door and rape you that night. That is the best feeling. And I think it's the idea that you're safe, that no one is going to harass you now. No one is going to abuse you. No one is going to harm you physically or beat you for no reason, that these women are after. And most of them tell me it's that feeling. And when we feel that we're all right and we can face anything else.
Yeah, boy, that is a powerful takeaway. My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil, who was just in Baghdad, where she was looking into secret shelters for Iraqi women who are victims of violence. Shaima, always great to speak with you. Thanks for your time.
Always great to be with you, Marco.
That is Iraq. And then there's Afghanistan and the possibility of peace there. The big question is, can the bloodshed end? The violence is still there, but there might also be some hope. There's a new push now for peace talks involving the Taliban and the Afghan government. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on where the talks stand and what they mean for the Afghan people.
Last spring, I met a young, energetic businesswoman in Kabul. Narges Aziz Shahi is the owner of the Eye Cafe. When you walk into her shop, the smell of freshly brewed coffee hits you immediately. Clusters of young Afghan men and women chat, nursing steaming cups of tea and coffee.
One of my objectives for coffee shop is to introduce the coffee culture.
Aziz Shahi is one of a growing number of Afghan women who have quietly but defiantly started their own businesses in this male-dominated society.
Being a woman and running such a business is basically not for many people.
When I met her, things were going well for Aziz Shahi. She told me she was getting more and more customers. And what she needed for her business to really grow was stability and security. But there was little hope for that back in the spring.
Road blockages comes to the security situation. Any type of bomb blasts or suicide attacks would happen, so people get afraid and they would like to hang out.
For years, people like Aziz Shahi have yearned for peace in Afghanistan. And now, finally, after nearly two decades of war, there seems to be a glimmer of hope. Hope that opposing sides of the war can come together and talk. How did this moment come about? Let's go back to January last year.
There's no talking to the Taliban. We don't want to talk to the Taliban.
This was President Donald Trump almost a year ago.
There may be a time, but it's going to be a long time.
That long time actually took less than a year.
We're in very strong negotiations in Afghanistan right now.
That was Trump last week.
What appears to have happened this fall is that President Trump received a national intelligence estimate from the intelligence community about Afghanistan that was extremely negative.
Barnett Rubin is an expert on Afghanistan and Pakistan. He served as an advisor to the State Department and the United Nations.
So he said, all right, enough of this. I'm not going to be running for president in 2020 with troops still in Afghanistan. We have to have a plan to get out.
To have a plan to get out, Trump appointed Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad. He's Afghan-American and a former diplomat with years of experience in Afghanistan and Iraq. His job is to get the Afghan government and the Taliban to come to the negotiating table, something that's been especially hard to achieve in the past.
The Taliban claim they are fighting the United States, not the so-called puppet government that it has installed. The Afghan government says they're not really fighting the Taliban. They're fighting against Pakistan, which is giving a safe haven to the Taliban. And neither was really prepared to talk seriously to the other.
But in the past few weeks, the Afghan government and the Taliban have been signaling that they're interested in talking. Taliban representatives met with State Department officials in Qatar, the small Persian Gulf country where the group has a political office. And President Ashraf Ghani appointed a 12-member negotiating team that consists of men and women to represent his government. So far, they're not in direct talks, but all of this has created a sense of optimism and anxiety.
It's just the beginning of it. It's not yet having a shape. It's just the willingness to begin the talk.
Nader Nadiri is a former advisor to President Ghani. 17 years ago, when the U.S. toppled the Taliban regime, Nadiri participated in talks that led to a new government in Afghanistan. He says looking back, that process felt rushed. There was a push to get an Afghan government up and running fast. He worries the same could happen again today with peace talks.
If you rush in reaching to a conclusion and an agreement out of desperation, that will not give us a sustainable peace.
Naderi says things like election, freedom of press, women's rights, education for girls, these are some of the hard-won achievements of the Afghan people after the Taliban fell. The Taliban of the 1990s didn't believe in any of that.
The Taliban cannot, on one hand, say that they want to engage in peace, on the other hand, to emphasize on their version of Afghanistan that is not anymore.
Afghanistan has moved on, he says. It's important that the Taliban understand that.
Salam alaikum. Yeah, I can hear you.
I wanted to know what Narges Aziz Shahi, the 28-year-old cafe owner in Kabul, thinks of all this. So I called her up on WhatsApp.
I would say, yes, this is a time to make peace with Taliban. But I do have this afraid in my mind also that what if the male-dominant society that Taliban had created, they follow that one? Or what if they put some criteria that females cannot work outside the home?
When the Taliban was in power, they did put severe restrictions on women. So Aziz Shahi has reason to be worried. But for now, she's focused on her business. She tells me, since we last met, she's opened up a second cafe in Kabul. It's the kind of place where you can grab lunch, sip coffee, play pool, and read a book.
So we have a small library, and people who like more music, and people who like playing snooker. For the fast food, we have Italian pizza.
Aziz Shahi hopes that the Taliban, the U.S. and the Afghan government can come up with a peace deal. She wants to see an end to the bloodshed. But she also hopes that somewhere in the documents they sign, there's a line that guarantees the rights of women like her. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
There's also a push for a peace deal to stop the war in Yemen. And this week, the U.N. Special Envoy to Yemen managed a small miracle. Martin Griffiths got the warring parties to go to a conference center outside Stockholm, Sweden. Yesterday, the government side and the rebel side agreed to the first of several UN-proposed confidence-building measures. The two sides will swap thousands of prisoners detained during nearly 4 years of war.
The prisoner swap is actually big news, and it especially means a lot to Yemenis.
Hisham Alomesi is from Yemen. He was also a detainee taken from his home in the Yemeni capital by secret police last year. They held him for 5 months in a prison run by Yemen's Houthi rebels. Hisham and his family live in Cairo now. We spoke with him this afternoon about the planned release of thousands of prisoners who were captured in the Yemeni civil war.
I remember what my family had to go through during my detention. They constantly worried that I wasn't going to make it alive out of the prison. They didn't even know where I was. I was kept in a dungeon for 5 months, solitary confinement. It was a 1 meter by 1 meter and a half cell. I had no windows. There was no light for the first 2 weeks. And I was literally buried alive. People asked me when I stepped out of prison, when I was released, will I be seeking revenge against the Houthi, against my captors? But the one thing I kept insisting on repeating was that I don't want vengeance. I don't want revenge. What has happened has already happened. Let's try and promote peace. So to my family, to the prisoners inside those cells, it means a lot that there was a breakthrough, that there's going to be a prisoner swap. The prisoner swap is going to mean basically giving them a second chance at life.
Yemeni political analyst and former political prisoner Hisham Alomesi. He spoke with us about the prisoner swap brokered by the UN this week in Sweden, which may help pave the way for further talks to end the Yemen war. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. So an African king walks into a barbershop.
I'm King Jaffe Jofer, ruler of Zamunda.
Yeah, well, have a seat. Chair number two be ready in a second.
That barbershop in Eddie Murphy's Coming to America was one of many influences in a new play by Nigerian Inua Elams. Barbershop Chronicles is set in
Accra, Ghana.
Also in Johannesburg, Harare, Lagos, London, as well as
Kampala, Uganda.
Yeah, Kampala, Uganda. Ever since he was a kid in Jos, Nigeria, Inua Elams has found himself listening in on the conversations in barbershops. Mundane chatter about hair loss and soccer, or deeply personal conversations.
There are not many places, certainly in the United Kingdom, where black men can gather without a suspicious lens through which their activities are seen, without a voyeuristic eye from people like the police or just people who aren't part of that community. And Africans tend to be a little bit louder than others. As a West African, that is specifically so. We are crazy. Nigerian specifically, there's something in the water, meaning that when we gather, we just tend to be loud. We tend to be noisy. And that tends to be frowned upon. And then we feel our souls, our spirits, sort of shrink inwards a little bit. But in barbershops, where that culture is expected, it is the perfect space for it.
I was 12 when I first felt an electric razor. Fell asleep in the chair. It was so soothing.
On the continent, barbershops have always been there. Men have always gathered to beautify themselves. And sometimes a barbershop was just a place under a tree and a dude with a blade. And people will come and sit down, queue up for haircuts. So it's an old thing.
You grew up in Jos in Nigeria. What was your barbershop as a kid?
Oh, my God.
Was it under a tree or was it like a barbershop?
No, it was we were middle-class Nigerians. So it wasn't under a tree. Though, when I was researching the play, I did meet a barber whose barbershop was just a slab of granite with a man's head drawn on it on the side of the road. And we just talked.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo in West Africa. And I did go to this place that was under this little straw kind of roof.
Yeah.
And they used a razor blade with no water and no soap.
Oh, whoa.
That was my haircut.
That's
it was crazy.
Real.
Yeah. There is so much to unpack in Barbershop Chronicles. For example, there's a frank conversation about the treatment of gays in Uganda.
Mm.
Why are you defending the gay? This is not natural to Uganda.
It is happening everywhere, so it is natural it will happen here. Kwame, who visited last week, the Ghanaian businessman, you know, he's just settled in London. Huh? I wanted to do business with him, but he says Ugandan exports are facing discrimination
Rubbish.
Because we're attacking the gay. So now it is bad for business. Just leave the gay alone. It is not your problem.
Have you actually heard that conversation yourself in a barbershop?
Yeah.
And how does it square with the masculinity that, you know, even though these men are making real efforts at being vulnerable, that masculinity never really leaves a stage?
I was in Kampala and I heard that conversation.
And we should say that life for homosexuals in Uganda is especially rough.
That's what I expected because of how the story is reported in the West. But most of the men weren't really bothered about it. Instead, they talked about the impact it had on export and businesses, and that was the interest because it was now hitting them in the pocket.
There's another conversation, also pretty intense, about why a jobless black man would choose to date a white woman over a black woman. Let's hear that.
The thing is,
uh-huh.
if you don't have a good job,
uh-huh.
and a white woman and a black woman both like you,
uh-huh.
I'll choose the white woman.
Oh.
Two reasons. One, no dowry. Hey, two, the white woman can do anything if she loves you. Yeah. But the black woman, it won't happen.
Yeah. Huh?
She'd like to, but when she tells her mom, how long have you known him? Eh? Is he Nigerian?
Uh-uh.
Eh, the criminals. Oh. See, but the white woman, eh? Even if her people don't like you, she will always follow her heart.
It doesn't seem like it's too hard for the character of Muhammad there to talk about his experiences. Is it a difficult conversation to have? And again, it's probably dependent on what class of barbershop you go to.
Yeah, I don't think it's a difficult conversation to have at all. I mean, the Muhammad that I met, that's his name in the barbershop, he was just standing and just talking about all of this in the open and people were laughing. I don't think it's difficult to talk about. It might be difficult for white women or white people to hear about the sort of internal politics in relationships. It's a sad thing to think about. We should feel free enough to love who we love, and that can be the end of it. But it tends to be a little bit more complicated. Here in the West, we think about romance as the most important factor in determining relationships, and it doesn't work in other parts of the world. And I think this is one of the things Muhammad is really ghosting, is trying to bring to the surface here. But he gets it confused between race and culture, which another character later in the scene clarifies.
So I'm speaking with playwright Inua Elams, whose play Barbershop Chronicles was a sellout at the London National Theatre, is now in Cambridge at the American Rep. One of the play's most powerful moments, Inua, deals with the unresolved anger stemming from South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Look at our society! The fact that we never got to deal with it manifests in violence! Men who rape children, beating women, If criminals hijack a car, they slit the driver's throat. We are still frustrated. Generations! Emasculated! Being called boys for centuries, taking it out on each other because we never got to get mad and say that we were f***ed around for 350 years! And no one was held accountable?
I said, it's a pretty powerful moment. I imagine there are some things discussed in Barbershop Chronicles that will confuse and even worry some liberal Western audiences. Mm-hmm. The assertion that Robert Mugabe, the ex-president of Zimbabwe, was heroic for Africans, even though he became a despot. Or Mandela was too soft on the whites of South Africa, and Winnie, his wife, would have done the country right and made the whites to account for apartheid. How widespread are those views, and how are your audiences in the West reacting to them?
I traveled to all of those countries. I met all of those men, and they told me what they believed about their leader. Some of them were said because they were acutely aware of how they were demonized in the West and wanted to protect these extensions of themselves. Some of them were said because they actually believed those things. And there are reasons why, you know. We look at how Gaddafi was reported. At some point in his history, he was the jewel of the desert.
Muammar.
Muammar Gaddafi, yeah. He was the jewel of the desert. Lots of Western countries looked at him as being this forward-thinking leader until he suddenly wasn't. You know, the British government did that. The U.S. government did that. So at some point, when these African leaders begin to step out of the bounds of play we give to them, then we twist them. And also, Mandela was deemed as a terrorist by the British government and by the American government. At some point, it switched. So everything in the play is true. History, you know, declaims that. And again, my job as a writer, as a searcher for the truth, was just to listen, to tidy up the language and to present it again.
Inwa Ellums is a playwright and the man behind Barbershop Chronicles. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed speaking with Inwa. And his play was pretty darn good, too. That'll do it for us this week. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend, everybody.
PRI, Public Radio International.